All right, so yeah, I'll just get started and let people keep falling in if they do come. So I'm going to be talking about this project called Nomos Tree. It's sort of an awkward name, but the name's not too important. Before I get started here, though, before I talk about what, I think it's really important to talk about why. Why I'm here, why I care about what I do. And the most important thing that really drives me is free software. I'm very passionate about it, and I just think it's always been important since ever since Richard Stallman started the GPL and before that. Secondarily, I just have a lot of fun working in this community and hang out with the people and interacting with people all over the world. It's awesome. But fourthly, Red Hat Enterprise Linux is very important to me, and GNOME is a very important component of Red Hat Enterprise Linux. And so when I ship this product to our enterprise customers, I want to know that GNOME is providing Red Hat Enterprise Linux with high-quality software. So all these things are important. All these things drive me. So secondarily, though, it's important just to restate our assumptions briefly. Why is GNOME here? Well, this is all from a website. Obviously, the software freedom part is in common with my goals. The other ones are important. But I want to dive into this connected aspect, because I think that's really an interesting part. It's probably the most interesting to me. So this is sort of the way I think of it, is GNOME is an ecosystem. And we have our centers of gravity, and I'll talk about those in a minute. And obviously, we interact with all different kinds of other ecosystems to a greater or lesser degree. Looking at this list, obviously, we share a lot with the GNU project. Tizen is there and uses some GNOME components. Red Hat Enterprise Linux, very important to me, obviously, uses a lot of GNOME. And there's the programming languages, the Pythons, Perls, Monos, and other ones like Open and Embedded, which in turn are linked to other ecosystems. Open and Embedded is linked to Wind River and all these other embedded devices and stuff like that. So it's important to sort of just visualize there's all these ecosystems around, and GNOME is there around the center of gravity. At least that's the way I think of it. So with that background, what I'm going to talk about is just a build system. But I'm really excited about it, which you guys may have noticed if you've seen it online, because I've just kind of always wanted this, and it's been so successful now. So my goal with this build system is to focus on GNOME's core centers of gravity and not exclude other things, but just make sure that we're doing well what is important to us. And I'll talk about that in a minute. The continuous aspect, so it is building, but it's also testing continuously. And I could talk for the rest of this whole session about continuous integration and why it's so important, but I'm just going to gloss over that. So it's testing a lot of Git repositories, a lot of what makes up core GNOME. So kind of when I started this project, I started from just a sort of minimal system and built up from scratch until I got to GNOME Shell. I wanted to just minimize interactions with other things so we can, again, focus on our core aspects. So it's tracking a lot of Git repositories. For example, all 100 and some XOR Git repositories, most of which are basically just the protocols and never change. And of course, all of GNOME, network, the things that are important, network manager, systemd. I want to make sure that GNOME works well with the latest systemd. So tracking systemd Git master, very important to me. The base system, this is sort of stuff that I just don't care about. For example, NSPR, NSS, OpenSSL, those all come from Open Embedded. And basically, I ran make, some binaries popped out, they appeared to work. That's about the level of QA that I gave to them. Also crucial is that I have a sort of core focus with this, and that it's only targeting virtualized environments because There's many reasons for this. One is that doing testing with virtualization is so much easier than trying to have like a test lab wired to physical hardware. That's a whole other level of management. Virtualization is really easy. I can script QEMU, make it do a dance when I want it to. It's great. And of course, there's other aspects to this. Like, there's no security updates because you basically need people there employed to do that. And obviously, my employer does this. I'm not trying to compete with them, obviously. So that's the sort of high-level summary of what this project is, and kind of hopefully just as important what it is not. So the core values of GNOME as I see them, obviously we have the GTK stack. Glib is very, very important to me because I think it's a fundamental basis for writing modern applications. It has the event loop. It has a file system abstraction, a bunch of stuff that really is a core part of an operating system, and I'd like to see it used more, particularly in Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Also in GNOME, we have the accessibility internationalization, also part of our core values. And the secondary list is kind of my list. Software engineering, very important to me. All the basics of doing continuous integration, you know, just are we leaking memory? You know, just, again, the basics. And I am trying to sort of push for a split between the operating system, applications, and then OS extensions. And I'll talk about this a bit more later. But just to repeat again, the goal of the system is to focus on GNOME's core values and feed that code, continue to feed that code, as we have been doing for years, back into these other ecosystems. So the non-goals, no enterprise features, no packaging. No enterprise features, there's no, you know, if you want Kerberos, for example, that's not something that, you know, I'm gonna test. NFS home, again, not something I'm gonna test. Testing GTK, glib. So what has the system achieved? Well, it's been online, deployed in the GNOME data center since December-ish. And since then, it's been building fairly reliably, and very importantly, without human intervention. I'll talk a little bit about the details of how that works, but a lot of times, it's just building while I'm off doing something else, and it's just working fine. But more importantly than the building, it's been doing testing, and I'll talk a little bit about the details of that.
You want numbers?
Yeah, I have some numbers later. So this is something that I'm most proud of, the time from a Git push to something like glib into when I'm booting a virtual machine is down to minutes now. And depending on the type of change, depending on the type of change, I think I could get that down to seconds. And that's always been my goal. It's totally possible. The other thing that's really important to me, and I talked about this last year a bit, but The story for how upgrades work is just crucial for GNOME, and it's something I just find deeply embarrassing about the current Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6, which I run, is that the upgrade system just doesn't know anything about the browser, and just it's not safe to upgrade. Like, you know, if you lose power halfway, so part of this project has actually been redesigning how updates work, and so using the OSTree system, upgrades are actually fully atomic. You can pull the power while they're running, and it's just sort of crucial. So even more interesting, there's a lot of tests that run now. So before, developers kind of ran make check periodically manually. Now I have automated make check of a lot of different modules. There's 350 test binaries, which in turn, because of gtester, in turn have a lot of tests. Depends how you measure, but this takes a couple minutes. I'll talk about that later. Another cool thing is that for a long time in GNOME, we didn't really test GDM that well. It was kind of Ray would run make, sudo make install in his laptop, but it's not something that fit in the JHBuild model, right? JHBuild only affects your session, and so sometimes GDM, well, it was kind of broken. But now, if GDM breaks, I'll know in minutes, and that's been working reliably. So I want to talk a little bit about the OSTree system. And how it's kind of different from the packaging model, because it's pretty crucial to how this system works. So OS tree itself is just kind of like a user space file system manager. And I like the term Git for operating system binaries. It's misleading in some ways, but in other ways, it's very accurate. So what OS tree does is it lets you parallel boot multiple versions of multiple operating systems without affecting the physical root directory of your operating system. So it's like Git in that it's a content address system, so it naturally deduplicates. So if you have multiple versions of GNOME installed, they only use space by proportion of how many files are different. So yeah, I'll talk a little bit more about that later too. It's different though from a lot of image-based deployment systems that have been prototyped out there. Like Red Hat Enterprise Linux had this stateless project for a while, which was basically a kind of image-based system where you download new data at the block level, and your Etsy is NFS mounted or something like that. OS tree is different from that because it does operate at the same level as package managers do, but unlike package managers, it's just a dumb content replication system. And this allows a lot of neat tricks. I'm going to show those in the next slide. OS tree, the way to think of it is really a mirror image of packages. Packages are lots of little file systems with some shell scripts that run as root attached, and they're uploaded in the internet. And then you assemble them on your client machine. In OS tree model, you replicate file systems from a build server, or you can generate them locally. And it is file system independent, so it does leverage some ButterFS features, mostly through glib. We automatically use the ButterFS ioctl for copy and write type stuff, but I think it's sort of important for a general purpose system to work on top of plain ext4, and that's actually what I tested on the most because ext4 is really fast. So it does have a format for installing on your local system, but it also has an archive format that can run on a web server. And that's sort of how the build system works, is there's the GNOME OS tree side, which is a build system. It commits to an OS tree repository, and then you can download it directly from just a plain old Apache. So here's some tricks that I want to make possible, and I've been prototyping this a little bit with Fedora. So I run Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6 on this laptop because people pay for subscriptions. I need to be able to fix it. But it's obviously important for me to be able to run GNOME Git Master because I want to be able to contribute to it and make sure that it still works for the next version. So the way I plan to have this work is I'll just have Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6 in my root partition, and then OS tree just sort of installs inside that without disrupting it. So I can have the GNOME OS tree, what's called Build Master, just the thing that's tracking the Git repositories. But you could also parallel install multiple versions of Fedora very easily. The hard part about this is fixing RPM to not be the lowest level anymore. So that's still in progress. But I do have the point where you can have the base system and then boot a newer one and test it working fine. And when I say 500 builds here, that's really possible because it just comes down to how many files are different. And between things just don't change that much, and there aren't a lot of big binaries, so you really can have 500 builds installed. And more interest, a neater trick that you could do is something like automated bisection, which is where you have your starting point, and you say, okay, I get graphics corruption recently, and sort of write a test binary that maybe just takes a screenshot and looks for the corruption, and then just keep booting into all these builds until you find the build that's broken. And from there, you can find the source code. A really neat OS tree trick, and this is kind of part of how the core QA system works, is it can update virtual machines while they're entirely offline. And this works basically because it's a dumb file system replication, and not like packages where you have these root shell scripts attached, and what do they do? OS tree has none of that, and so this is actually a very useful trick in general. And like I mentioned before, I'd like to see OS tree eventually slide underneath these package systems like dpackage and RPM and all that stuff, where OS tree would give the parallel booting, the atomic upgrades, that sort of stuff to them. So GNOME OS tree is layered on top of OS tree, and it's very simple. When I say there are no packages, I mean I went through the entire system and eliminated the concept at every level. as much as I could to try and gain reliability and sort of optimize for automation. So the NoMos tree layer has this thing called a manifest, which is literally just a list of Git repositories to build in order. It's very simple. And as a consequence of that simplicity, it has turned out to be, as the past 6 months I've proven, very, very reliable for multiple reasons. So if we look at like the example of what the manifest looks like, the libxml2 one, that's the entirety of what would be a package in my model. It's just a Git repository inserted to build in this order, and that's it. That just means track Git master of libxml2. And it's been doing that for quite a while. The component devel one, I'll talk about this on the next slide, but basically that means this is only for the developer image. I can also choose any Git revision to build at any time. Unlike dpackage and RPM, none of this cares about version numbers at all. So I can be tracking systemd git master and say, okay, I can no longer log in the current version, which has happened. So I say, okay, I'll just tag back to the previous revision. Build's done, like within minutes. It's completely unlike the package systems because they have this deep obsession with version numbers that permeates every single layer. So none of my system cares about version numbers at all, any Git revision at any time. And the Spice example is just how configure options and patches look. I originally was trying to only have Git repositories and no patches, just to force myself to feed changes back. But I sort of, it's too impractical, so I ended up having a couple of patches. So this is something that I think really illustrates just how different the OS tree model is from the package thing. So on the build server now, it's been doing continuous integration since December, right? There's over 6,000 complete file system trees. Like, I haven't lost any history, right? And it only occupies 60 gigabytes. And this is sort of the power of deduplication. So in theory, again, not only could you have 500 builds locally, you could download an entire history of all of the builds from the build server and look at those. Those all have links to their sources inside of them. So packages give a lot of flexibility, right? You can have a sort of base system and then add and remove stuff, whereas OS tree is all about the file system. So the way OS tree is sort of designed is that instead of having a bunch of little packages, you have full, complete systems that share space. So not only do you have multiple versions of, say, what I call a runtime tree, but you have a basic runtime tree, enough to run apps, and then I have an image devel with all the developer tools. And these just naturally share storage. So OS tree lets you switch between them atomically. So I normally run the developer image in my VMs, but sometimes we've had bugs where things, because of obscure issues, only work in the developer image. Like in package world, they need a dev or a devel package installed. I can easily just switch back to the runtime tree, which effectively hides all the developer tools from me. So yeah, parallel installing multiple file systems. And then besides all the four variants, there's actually three. The build system outputs a pipeline. So there's what I call build master, which is all these Git repositories get built, integrated into build master. All that happens there is they're just built. I just take the latest Git, run make install dester, and it's in the tree. And you can download that, and that's very useful, obviously. But I don't expect many humans to want to run that directly. So there's a secondary stage, which does what I call a smoke test. And this just updates a disk image, boots it in QEMU. Does this appear to let you log in? If it does, that gets tagged, just like Git repositories get tagged. And there's a secondary stage, which is integrated as after all the make check and stuff like that works. But the way I sort of envision this is as a long pipeline. You can imagine at the very top we have Buildmaster, and then something like Red Hat Enterprise Linux is like way down there. But it is a sort of long pipeline of increasingly extensive testing. But it's still really important to be able to run the Buildmaster because sometimes things have broken, and I want to be able to debug it locally. So you can download, develop, debug, run GDB on the latest GDM, and see what's going on. There's also a task that generates disk images after testing. So I want to talk about the story of after you run Git push to run in the Git repositories that are tracked here, what happens? Well, as far as I know, I'm the first person to ever demand push notification from GNOME Git. So that happens. And then we basically do a copy of the Git repository onto the build server. So this build task, though, an important thing to understand is speed of feedback is really important to me versus correctness. There are different trade-offs you can make here. So the build task only rebuilds the Git repository that changed, because concretely, I can't rebuild WebKit GTK every time GTK changes. It would just massively slow down the cycle. It assembles a build root, which means it's a clean build. And this is actually really important, because some things just really increases reliability. But this part's actually really fast compared to the dpackage pbuilder and the mock and those sort of tools. It averages anywhere from 5 to 20 seconds. And that's because it uses hard links and all this stuff. Actual building the thing, it starts from a clean Git repository. So this is also kind of important, because it'll, for example, instantly catch a missing file that you forgot to commit. But for something like glib, that's a couple minutes, and that's the same with jhbuild or RPM or whatever. And then the result of that install gets stored into a repository. And this is kind of like the package. The string here, the gnome os tree components, glib x86-64, that's kind of like a Git branch that gets stored in the repository. And then we assemble all of these. It just takes a union of all the different components. So I have glib, I have libsoup stored as their own little file system trees, and I just layer them on top. And that's very simple. So there's no dependency resolution, there's no packaging here. And that takes a minute right now. That's something I could speed up, but there's different trade-offs there. And after this, again, this is just like, for a null change for a very small module, this is around 2 minutes from Git push to when you can actually download it reliably. There used to be the concept of, yes, is the short answer. And I used to try and do triggers on the client side. Like, the idea was that you would download this tree, and then afterwards we would run stuff like GTK update, icon cache on the client. But I moved away from that because then I couldn't do the offline updates on a VM, and that was really crucial. So I sort of took the hit of having each multiple versions of the cached icon cache in each tree. It's not that bad, and it makes updates a lot faster, basically. Well, for the client. This is one of the things that does slow down the build process. For example, for some things, I have to rebuild the init RAMFS, whereas at least Fedora, and I don't know about Debian, rebuild the init RAMFS on the client every time your kernel changes. So in some cases, I pay a price on the build server, whereas in the package world, you pay on each client. Say it again, sorry?
How many are there?
How many different triggers? Seven or something, maybe, like for Pango, FreeType. I don't know. There's not that many. LD config. Yeah. I mean, I could look real quick. But those are all pretty fast to execute. I'm not excited about just building again. I think the testing part is really important to me. So yeah, it uses libguestfs to mount the file system as non-root. So this smoke test, the way it works is we have a cache disk image representing the runtime tree, you know, without all the developer tools. And then I make a little copy-on-write disk, and I add some testing stuff. For example, there's this service that runs in the virtual guest to export the systemd journal back out to the host, which then looks for stuff. So systemd has this nice concept of message IDs, which are basically like UUIDs, universal unique IDs, that some event happened, right? So an example would be systemd emits a message with a particular message ID when something core dumps. So if someone makes a commit to, say, network manager that causes it to just simply segfault on startup, the smoke test will fail. Furthermore, I patched gnome session to emit a particular message ID if one of the things it manages fails. Like, so for example, if gnome shell exits with an error, I know that pretty much instantly on the host, and I can terminate the VM. And then if you've seen IRC, the gnome hackers IRC, a red line for the smoke test, that's what this means. So most often it happens when people commit syntax errors in the gnome shell JavaScript files, lately anyways. And I detect that very quickly. And the integration test, this is something that I think is really neat too, which is before in the gnome release process, each developer ran make check kind of periodically, randomly. And then theoretically, you ran make disk check before release. So in the NOMOS tree model, I have all of the tests, almost all of the tests that you run on make check installed into the system. So I boot a virtual machine, and then I have a little testing framework that runs all of the tests after any change. So a translation update to GNOME Shell, I will rerun all the glib tests. I will rerun all the clutter tests. Because honestly, I have plenty of CPU power, and why not? I mean, eventually I want to have, you know, a more interesting test scheduling type system, but the build server has 32 cores, 64 gigs of RAM. I mean, it flies through this stuff. Yeah? So one thing that has occupied some of my time for a while now is race conditions in the tests. Glib in particular has a lot of tests with race conditions, and some of those have been hard to track down, but fortunately most of them are just bugs in the tests and not actual core code. But I did find one conceptual issue in glib from tracking down one of these. But for the most part, most of the tests did work already because the developers were running them, just not reliably, continuously. So they're just very different. So some things that I'd love to do with the system. How much time do I have left, by the way?
20 minutes.
20 minutes. Okay. Okay. Cool. So OpenSUSE has this really, well, they have this thing called OpenQA, which has some really cool features and some kind of weaker features. But they have a really nice web view, and I'd love to have something like that. Another feature that I want to add is Mozilla has try servers. So I want to have, does this patch break GNOME as a service, basically, where, there's no reason I couldn't just start building inbound patches in Bugzilla and testing them. So, you know, one of the GNOME shell developers could upload a bunch of patches, and I just take those, do a smoke test. That sort of thing would honestly be pretty fast. It's just, the tricky part is sharing stuff between the different builds. Like, all the Git repositories are about 4 gigabytes, and I don't want to reclone them for each build, but making sure, like, handling concurrency is just what's kind of stopped me a little bit from this. And I would love to get into, like, software engineering stuff. I mean, one of the things that I've always wanted is, you know, just a graph of how much memory we're using on the default login, how much memory we're using when Epiphany is on Wikipedia. I mean, just all sorts of data. There's no reason I can't gather this. The virtual machine aspect does, though, limit kind of the type of performance metrics that I can get. Like, I can't really get a boot chart because there's all this ambient I/O activity on the build server, and it would just be too noisy. You really need a nice, dedicated hardware lab. Yep.
Can you get a measure of I/O operations?
Probably, yeah. Yeah.
That's
true. Yeah, I think, there's many different ways to do it. I don't know if QMU has the hooks I would need for this. I mean, that would be a pretty reliable way to do it. Installing agents in the guest is obviously one way to gather a lot of stuff, but then, of course, you have the Heisenberg effect where you're affecting what you're measuring, right? Like, your agent is using memory, your agent is using CPU. So, I would love to have automated bisection on the build server. So, right now, if the smoke test fails, I basically just run git log, and, you know, it's usually pretty obvious who broke it and why, but a lot of times it's not, actually. And just like a try server, there's no reason I couldn't just allocate a builder and say, okay, I have this regression range. Well, in the NOMOS tree model, it's, of course, over 200 git repositories, so handling the multi-repository thing with bisection is an interesting problem. But again, there's no reason I couldn't do it, just haven't gotten around to it. Another cool thing is a little bit more blue sky. It's just a sort of live collaboration setup where the developer is actually running git push to a branch, and we instantly build it. So you have someone working on GNOME Shell and a designer, and the designer wants to see what the developer is doing. There's no reason I couldn't just allocate a server that just sort of tried to do that as fast as possible and let them almost live collaborate. So that in a nutshell is the system, but I have a lot to talk about where I see the high-level future of the system. So obviously, okay, I guess I didn't mention this, but there is no application installation mechanism in the system yet because it's a hard problem. It's very hard problem. And there's a lot of prior art in this sort of stuff. There's like Listolar, or however you pronounce it. There's Ubuntu's Click Packaging. There's AutoPackage and all this stuff around. And they have different trade-offs. But the thing that is very important in this discussion, I think, is to draw a very strong line, a very strong distinction between free software applications and proprietary ones. Because I think they demand, there's some commonality there, but I don't understand why so many people in free software have this obsession with generating binaries and caching them. I mean, the most important thing, if you're talking about free software, is the source code, right? And who's committing to that and why, and not this package stuff. So for free software applications, I'd really like to emphasize that sort of stuff, like who's writing this app, you know, let you run the latest version, help you contribute to it, that sort of thing. There is, though, the aspect where it is important to say who built it, because you obviously have to generate binaries to run it, but it's still important to say who built it. So, for example, if we had a system for applications, and we're doing continuous integration on Epiphany and outputting zip files or something, who knows, doesn't matter, it's still important to say built by GNOME, because you have to trust the builder. And so I think the aspect of the intermediary is still important. But yeah, again, I would love to do continuous integration for the applications. I sort of caved and added some core apps to the manifest. So, you know, obviously Epiphany is in there. GNOME Terminal, the system would be completely useless without it. And those are those are available, but the real future I do want to get to is where you can remove the web browser from the operating system, because apparently that's important. And just, you know, peer review. I mean, this is the same thing I'd like to see for the core operating system, is just emphasizing the peer aspect of free software. Who's doing this and why? Okay. So obviously, this has been a kind of controversial topic throughout GNOME, and it really gets to the heart of the distinction between what an operating system is and what a distribution is and that sort of thing, which is where do you draw the line for what lives where, right? What might applications have to bundle? So stuff like libxml2, I'm not a big fan of libxml2. I really wish that it had been a nice glib library before, but you know, do we accept that as part of our base platform and its ugly API? I don't know. Stuff like Cairo, obviously, we made the decision. Yeah, this is part of the platform. It's part of GTK. Spell checking is a pretty much perfect example of something where, well, we kind of have some libraries out there. They may not be great. Whether that gets shipped with the base system or not, I don't know. And of course, even if we're just talking about core GNOME, how long do we ship GTK 2? Allow is the wrong word. Should application developers still target it in some circumstances? And of course, we're talking about GTK 4 in the horizon. How long would we ship GTK 3? Sort of the way I define operating system is something your application will run on forever. And if we remove stuff, then we're not really an operating system anymore. We're kind of moving back towards a distribution model. So I don't have answers to these questions. I've sort of punted on it and said, okay, well, I'm just going to, in order to make an operating system, we need to have basic quality assurance. And so that's what I've been working on for a while, like just fixing race conditions in the glib tests and making sure that we're shipping a platform that can be used to build applications, and how all that works. Yeah, still a lot of questions to answer there. So I think the needs of proprietary applications are totally different. For one thing, they're tied to an architecture usually. If we're talking about native binaries, then all of a sudden you're kind of in the Windows world where you have applications that were targeting x86, and then if we want to move to a new hardware platform, we can't do it. Yeah, I think this sort of thing, our few ISVs can just sort of deal with it. So I'm not too focused, again, on the proprietary applications. Basically, what I want, I think it's important to enable people to run proprietary software, but not encourage it necessarily. And so I'm going to focus my time on just the core free software GNOME applications, because that's, again, why I'm here from the beginning of the talk. So this is something that I was actually hacking on the plane, which is basically just systemd for the user session. This is kind of just a core operating system feature, but using this, we could actually, this would be something that would help enable running proprietary applications, because for that, we sort of do need a sandboxing type mechanism, and how that would work is pretty interesting. A long time ago, I helped port SE Linux to Debian, so I have a fair amount of expertise in that, and I think it makes sense to use SE Linux for part of it. But the portals work is sort of essential for user interaction pieces. So you have a sort of unchanging applications must never do this type layer, and then a sort of maybe more Android or iOS-like dynamic application asks to do this type of model, and that's portals. But yeah, in order to do this, we really need systemd in the session, because it enables grouping binaries for an application. Like right now, one of the things that's sort of core part of the GNOME 3 model is it's application focused, and the way we match the X window created by an app to the process is actually just really horrible, and I'd like to move away from it. So getting applications inside a C group would just be a fundamental enabler for moving towards this OS application split. I'd love to unify the idea of operating system extensions. So stuff like proprietary NVIDIA drivers, what I think of as an OS extension. The package model sucks for this, because honestly, what you really want is you want to have your system, and then you say, okay, I'm gonna install the NVIDIA driver, and then effectively rebase. Whereas right now, the package manager will say, okay, well, this package needs this and won't let you upgrade. What was really important is to enable someone to say, to update the base, toss out the NVIDIA driver, try Nouveau, does the new version work, and not have the package manager, you know, complaining over here. So that's an OS extension. Fonts, that sort of stuff, or VPN plugins, all OS extensions. And yeah, unify those with the GNOME shell extensions. So in conclusion, core quality is important to me. Free software is very important to me, but quality is basically job one. If we don't do that, we're just not really doing anything. I want to provide sane application framework. And there's, besides just the core, how are they distributed, just making it easy to, getting exposed to the auto tools is really rough for a lot of application developers. And so I want to still allow people to package things. So concretely, applications should still have a make install type stage, I think. But the build systems really do need to evolve to the point where it is possible and easy to write an application without being exposed to all of those horrors. And of course, absolutely essential to this is just maintaining our links with the various downstream projects, like Debian, Red Hat Enterprise Linux. I mean, all that stuff that was in the beginning. But I have, again, tried to focus the system. I'm not trying to be Debian, so it's just focusing around our core quality. So making sure that's good, and then feeding changes elsewhere. Yeah, and then if you want to know more about the project, these are some mailing lists. I'm usually available on IRC, and you can always shoot me a mail. So that's it. I know I kind of blew through this, but are there any questions? Yeah, Alex.
Do you have any thoughts on reproducible libraries? Do you always use the same tools to track?
Okay. Oh, sure. So the question was about build reproducibility. So particularly, like, are the binaries identical, that sort of? Yeah, okay, so all the binaries go in the OS3 repository. A good way to answer this question is probably to talk about what this other project, NixOS, does, and this is one of the ones that I was looking at when I was doing research for this project. So Nix does checksums too, but they checksum all the input to a build. So for example, if an environment variable changes, that outputs a different checksum, obviously. And they're obsessed with this stuff. But there's a lot of things that sabotage that, like Python PYC files have the timestamp of the file they're referencing, which is useless in my system. It hasn't been important, because I have plenty of disk space.
Do you know what compiler or a specific build was using?
Sorry. Yeah, I see what you're more asking now. Yeah, stored in each generated tree is the manifest. Actually, what I call a resolved manifest. So if you remember back, where was this? Yeah, back here. So the resolved manifest is like the Harfbuzz example, where it has the exact Git revisions of the Git repository that were used to build this tree. That doesn't necessarily make it reproducible exactly, because I'm not putting in the manifest what the host. The whole system uses Open Embedded as a cross-environment. So I start from Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4, which is what spinner.gnome.org runs, and then it cross-builds GCC from that. So if you wanted fully reproducible builds, I'd probably have to put in the manifest built from whatever. And that's something I could improve, but yeah. In the back, Adam? Okay, sorry.
I was just going to be loud, but whatever.
I promise you I can be loud enough. So you say you're not rebuilding, like when you rebuild GTK, you don't rebuild WebKit GTK.
Right, exactly.
Do you have like a throwaway, have you considered a throwaway method of doing that, of saying, you know, I'm not going to keep the build results from this, but I would like, now that I know that I changed glib and rerun the integration tests later, but that only says whether the binaries you produced at this point in time work against the glib you happen to have installed, not whether they will happen to rebuild afterwards.
That's right, and I have had problems with that. Concretely right now, soname bumps are a little annoying, like when Coggle bumps soname, mm-hmm. I have to force a rebuild of things. And so the way that works is at the bottom, I just have this thing I call build epoch. So if I update this version and I type in glib, GTK3 here, that will just force a rebuild of those things. Okay. The build server will just delete its caches. And I've had to do that, well, as you can see, 20 times in the last 6 months, which...
That's pretty reasonable, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, it's worked pretty well. Okay.
Have you put any thoughts on doing analysis of the binaries to make sure that we're not breaking ABI?
Yeah. For sure. It's kind of helped a lot. The integration test phase helps a lot. So if the ABI of glib broke, right now we would run binaries that glib itself built. But if, for example, I would know if glib broke ABI in a way that broke GTK, as long as they didn't both get rebuilt at the same time. But as far as more static analysis type stuff, like you're thinking maybe like upstreamtracker.org or whatever, like they have some...
Yeah, or an API that is maybe less exposed than GTK, change its ABI and being able to notice.
Okay.
If a test doesn't break, but we could analyze between versions the actual ABI of both of them and make a diff and say, okay, this symbol has changed its signature or something like that.
Right. Well, of course, yeah, the libraries themselves do have ABI. I mean, glib has a list of exported symbols, so it's very difficult to break ABI there, but yeah, I mean, it's a question of what we do with the data. Like, I could generate that data, but what do we do with it? You know, do I go back to, you know, Daniel and say, okay, you broke libxml2 ABI? That would probably be very useful for him, but yeah, I don't know. I just haven't. It hasn't come up, I guess. Yeah, but yeah.
So we're running out of time. So just one last question, and then you can go and ask your question directly to Colin.
Okay.
Hi, that kind of works into my question, which is how do we subscribe when we break something? Because obviously it's just you at the moment pinging me on IRC saying you've broken X, Y, Z.
Yeah,
that doesn't really scale.
Right. I don't know. I mean, it can obviously be a collaborative thing. Jasper watches the output too, and you know, he looks at the output. Yeah.
But would it make sense to be able to say, send me an email when I break something?
I could. Well, I think that would potentially come out of automated bisection. Because the thing is, things can break for reasons that are not your fault. That happens pretty often. Like, systemd has a very complex build system, and toolchain bugs sometimes just bite. And, you know, is it a toolchain issue? Because they use F function sections. It doesn't matter, but basically it's not always their fault.
It's like you need a human involved to say, actually, I triage this.
Yeah, I mean, but I certainly could harvest the email addresses from the Git repositories, and yeah, I mean, it hasn't broken that. It doesn't usually break that often.
One email per day.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. It's funny, like some days things just break left and right, and other times it'll go 3 days and I just don't even touch it, and it's just silently building out. So, yeah. All right, I think that's it. All right, well, thank you all for coming.